I am here with Françoise Boucher-Saulnier, Legal Director of the International Medical Organization Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, which stands for Médecins Sans Frontières, and author of the book The Practical Guide to Humanitarian Law, the third English edition of which has just been published in the US. Françoise, thanks for being with us on the Global Observatory. Let's start with a startling paradox. International humanitarian law, also known as the law of armed conflicts, is the most widely accepted body of international law, with virtually every single state in the world having ratified the 1949 Geneva Convention. Yet, from Syria to South Sudan and the Central African Republic, it remains blatantly disregarded and civilians continue to bear the brunt of conflict. Does this mean that humanitarian law devised in the 20th century is not adapted anymore to the 21st century conflicts?
No, I think it would be a great danger to consider that international humanitarian law is not adapted anymore. There was an attempt to say that we have entered a new era of conflict. It was led by the United States during the war against terror, when they in fact invented this third type of conflict that would be completely new and that would require new rules, and pretending that the ancient one was not adapted. Well, in fact, if humanitarian law is not respected today, it is not, in fact, showing that it is here adapted to the conflict. The fact that it is not respected shows that it is useful. And law is never respected per se. I mean, what is important is that law frame must be respected. And international humanitarian law has evolved slowly through ages, starting with very small humanitarian issues like the medical mission, and then trying to enlarge this medical mission to the issue of detention, and then in the Geneva Convention in 1949, it enlarged it to the protection of civilian population, meaning that before 1949, protection of civilian was not a matter for international humanitarian law. So this evolution that has really culminated in 1949 with the issue of the protection of the civilian population is something quite new in humanitarian law, quite new, and still at the core and at the center of the problem today, because usually in situation of conflict, armed groups, armies try to fight, avoiding direct confrontation and trying to find soft target. And the civilian are the soft target of war, which is not new at all. And this is why, I mean, it must be recalled that the protection of civilian and the relief, humanitarian relief to civilian population and to victim of conflict remains an essential battle, but it has to be fought. The military, the army, they fight together. The humanitarian, they must also stand for those rights. They are not granted. Not even the medical mission. It's not granted. You have to argue. You have to fight for it because it is strategic. So this is as old as the history of conflict. And the fact is that even if it is violated, it remains highly relevant and it remains a matter for major commitment from humanitarian organization. There's no place for despair, no place to think that things was better before. Things have never been better before.
Still, some would argue that most of international humanitarian law has been developed at an era where we had mostly states and regular armies fighting each other, and that today's civilians are often at the center of conflict, at the center in terms of the main target in some conflicts, or also sometimes they are very much the actors of violence, those taking up arms and creating some difficulties to identify them as civilians. And I'm thinking about Syria, I'm thinking about Central African Republic. So what would you respond to them?
I think that international humanitarian law is designed for parties to the conflict. There is effectively kind of legal asymmetry in situation where parties to the conflict are a state on one side and non-state actor on the other. The fact that international humanitarian law was developed first for international armed conflict was the reality after the Second World War. Now, most of the conflict are happening within a state, meaning that they are non-international armed conflict. Nevertheless, there are international humanitarian law applicable to it, which is mainly the additional protocols from 1977. So the mere fact of a conflict opposing the state and non-state armed group has already been codified. So it's not new. It's not new per se. But it creates some kind of legal asymmetry and practical problem, because those non-international armed conflict tends to be very polarized, radicalized. But look at history, international armed conflict were not, you know, sort of gentlemen parties. So there is a real legal asymmetry, but the rules that are existing allows for a number of different provision for relief on one side and number of provision for the restraint in the use of force. This use of force is not always restrained by the state in situation where the state pretend to act for the restoration of public order. Let's take the example of Syria, and they overuse forces in the sake of restoring public order. In the situation of Central African Republic, the situation is the reverse. The state is completely absent. And there's a non-international armed conflict where the parties to the conflict are non-state actors. The state is nowhere. And those non-state actors are partially non-organized. But it does not change the reality that it's easy in the field to make the difference between the one taking arms and participating in the conflict and the one victim of it. And there are still civilians in this conflict, and there are members of armed groups, well organized or not well organized, fragmented or not. Again, also the same situation that happened in Syria, with the opposition being fragmented and not well organized. It doesn't mean that it is not a conflict. The fact that you cannot clearly identify the hierarchical chain of command of the opposition, and the fact that there's not one single non-state armed group fighting with the governmental forces, is just the reality. But still, the distinction between civilian and combatant is possible to do. And if we look at the contribution of the additional protocols in 1977, in fact, they get rid of this opposition between civilian and combatant. They only look at victim of the conflict. Because in fact, a civilian or a combatant is of interest of international humanitarian law by the time he has become victim. I mean, he has lost power because he's wounded, because he's sick, because he's detained, because he is besieged, because all that. So today, this opposition is not that relevant to international humanitarian law. What is really of interest is the situation of victim of the conflict. The one that are able to fight, they fight, and they don't need so much help. But by the time they need help, by the time they've fallen, it is the time where international humanitarian law do recognize rights for the treatment, human treatment, and do recognize rights for impartial humanitarian organization to take initiative to bring relief, including medical relief.
There is another paradox that I would like to discuss. In the introduction to your book, you mentioned somewhere that the development of international criminal jurisdictions and mechanisms, which sanction violations of humanitarian law, might have paradoxically been detrimental to the respect of this body of law. Isn't it a bit counterintuitive, and can you explain this point?
I wouldn't say detrimental to the implementation of the respect, but what I want to say is that the interpretation of criminal law is completely different from the rule of interpretation of humanitarian law. Criminal law abide to strict rules of interpretation, which is usual and normal. While when it comes to humanitarian law, you need and you must have very wide rules of interpretation, because humanitarian law must cover all situation. And in international humanitarian law, every situation or individual must be covered with a system of mutually exclusive category. So either it's a war or it's not a war, either you are a combatant or a civilian, but you cannot be nothing. It means that humanitarian law must be interpreted in good faith, by analogy, in an extensive manner, while when you look at humanitarian law through a sort of criminal prism, you are obliged to adopt a very restrictive interpretation. And I take the example of the definition of conflict. A number of lawyers have used the criminal jurisprudence to stick to the very word of articles of the Geneva Convention protocols regarding definition of conflict. Every single word, comma, silence, which is not at all what humanitarian law is made for. I take the example of the definition of non-international armed conflicts, just to remind that Common Article 3 has decided not to define those non-international armed conflicts, to make sure that they are defined only per opposition to international armed conflict. This was very wise. In 1977, there was a will to qualify more non-international armed conflict to create more rights, more duties also, for parties to the conflict and for the government in such situation. But, for instance, the Protocol 2 say, is a non-international armed conflict, is a conflict occurring in the territory of a country between national armed forces and dissident group. If you look at Yemen, for example, you have conflict where a government is acting in the territory of another without being directly exposed in its own territory. If you look at Central African Republic, you have a conflict occurring within the territory of Central African Republic without involving the governmental forces. So all those conflict falls into non-definition. If you have a very strict interpretation of those definitions, they are nothing. There was also the question of what is happening in Eastern Congo, conflict that was said to be transnational conflict, where the territorial state doesn't match with the place where the conflict is happening. So criminal jurisprudence has really fueled a number of doctrines saying that a number of conflicts are not defined in the Geneva Convention and Protocols, and they are this kind of third type category of conflict, such as the war on terror, that falls nowhere within the humanitarian law and must be covered by new law. This is exactly the perverse and the adverse effect of a criminal interpretation of the Geneva Convention and Protocols. I would even add something else. It is through international criminal jurisprudence that violation of Article 3 Common have been acknowledged by the judges as a war crime. It was made by the Tribunal on Former Yugoslavia because at that time there was no definition of war crime for non-international armed conflict. So they say, okay, fine. Violation of Article 3 Common is a war crime. Article 3 Common was a kind of broad entry point for every single situation that exceeded internal tension and trouble to enter in and to develop humanitarian assistance, humanitarian initiative, humanitarian special agreement, so contractual application of humanitarian law. And then it's not so surprising to see that during the war on terror, the US has declared that Article 3 Common was not applicable, which is really the fundamental principle. My guess is that they knew that this Article 3 Common was carrying some kind of criminal content, which was completely new, and that, in fact, led to a number of countries saying, no, it's not even a conflict. We are under the threshold of application of Article 3 Common. So this is just to show that there is a real tension between criminal interpretation and humanitarian interpretation that must remain always very, very broad to make sure it encompasses every situation that has not been envisaged before.
In the same vein, still in the introduction of your book, you write somewhere that, and I quote, relief actors cannot play the role of judges or human rights activists, as international criminal law would like them to, as indeed it might impact their ability to negotiate access and to safeguard humanitarian space. Yet a number of humanitarian organizations, including yours, MSF, engage in public advocacy as well in denouncing violations of humanitarian law. So how do you suggest to work around this tension between indeed criminal law, the need for justice, and the need for humanitarian action and concrete application of humanitarian law?
We ask to be granted, and we've asked for exemption to the International Criminal Court to make sure that we are not perceived as acting for the prosecution of an individual. Because when you are present in the field and you witness a situation which is obviously violation of humanitarian law, denouncing this situation is quite different than making a case against a given individual with whom you have to negotiate access. So saying that there are crimes is quite different from saying, I have proof against Mr. X, Y, or Z. And in terms of security and ability to be present in the field, we must be sure that when we discuss with someone, we are not, in fact, building a case against this person and that we will not be held to witness and to give our information to the prosecution office at the ICC. Otherwise, we would have no contact with people, because the very fact to show that you are in control for a leader of an armed group, if he is in control, if he is able to authorize MSF to do something, means that he is in control of. And this has very important criminal consequences. We had this case in Liberia with Taylor. In fact, he was able to help MSF get the release of an hostage. And then we were summoned by the court to show that because he was able to get our hostage release, he was effectively in control of a criminal group. So this is a very concrete example. Again, another example is that when we are in Central African Republic today, receiving in the hôpital communautaire during the fighting, hundreds of wounded every day, we are in fact able, I would say, to show that there has been people targeted, some were civilian, some may have been combatant. But we must refrain the office of the prosecutor to come in the hospital, look at the medical file, to make his case about the existence of war crime or others. Because there are other ways to prove that there has been wounded, to prove that there have been deliberate targeting of civilians. There are other ways. If the hospital is used to build criminal cases, it means that we will not be allowed to operate in the middle of conflict. We had exactly the same case in Abobo, in Ivory Coast, and we are fighting with the office of the prosecutor because, again, they wanted to have the medical files.
The office of the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court.
Exactly. But what is of interest for the office of the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court may also be of interest for the office of prosecutor, even of military prosecutor. I have another case in DRC where there was a cases of a massive rape of women allegedly by a member of the National Army, and under pressure of the fight against impunity, a military prosecutor requested access to the medical file of the medical post where those women were treated. And we resisted, MSF, we resisted very strongly, saying that if such things are allowed, violation of medical secrecy, seizure of medical files against the will of the victims, of the patient, then there will be no more access to medical care. Maybe there will be some prosecution for one case, but the final outcome for it that will be that the women will not be able to access medical care after rape. So we have to be very cautious with all those very good intentions that put pressure on the weakest point, which are the victims and the humanitarian workers. If we want to make justice, if we want to do prosecution and to end up with real indictment and effective condemnation, we have to release you because, in fact, we had no proof. We were not able to prove your culpability. Then the United Nations system and the ICC system must really build their strengths, not using proof from the weakest element of the system, which are the victim and the humanitarian organization.
Françoise, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.